so is the story of Maccabees. The only contemporary account we have of the events that led to the celebration of the holiday of Hanukkah. But here's the thing about the Book of Maccabees. It doesn't come to us sealed in some sort of perfect time capsule. It has a context of its own, a context of the historical events that happened before and after the rededication of the temple about which we read in the scripture. It also has a context of those who chose to preserve this story, the context of those who not only knew of this history, but wished for us to know of it 2,000 years later. And it has the context, too, of our own experience and our own life. So how to restore that context? Well, it's easy to restore the historical context. We believe it was probably about the year 163 before the Common Era in which this historical event took place. At this time, Jerusalem was under the control of the Greek Empire, and the Greek Empire was by and large fairly tolerant of Jewish religious observance. There was some discrimination against Jewish practice, but it wasn't really the overt discrimination that bothered Matthias the priest, Judah his son, and Judah's other four brothers. What disturbed the Maccabees, as they come to be known, was the assimilation that was going on among their fellow Jews. Many fellow Jews were attracted to Greek teachings, to Greek philosophy, Greek humanism, and even pagan ritual. And so in the temple itself, even high priests would carry Jewish names, and some of the rituals would be a blend of Jewish practice, pagan ideas new and learned from the Greeks, and humanist teachings from the Greek philosophy. And it was this against which Judah and his brothers led the revolt. If you read only the scripture, you think that perhaps this was just one battle to reclaim only the temple for purity of Jewish practice. But in fact, it wasn't one battle. It was decades of overt civil war in which tens of thousands of people died before the Maccabees gained control. And it was then, after the civil war is over, that they reclaim the temple and rededicate it. And so it is. The standard thinking of Hanukkah, the common line that one hears about Hanukkah, is that this is a holiday about the dangers of assimilation, and that this is a holiday that reminds us that sometimes to preserve tradition, we have to act boldly, even if we do so with violence. And yet, if you take the larger context of Hanukkah, you realize that cannot possibly be the teaching, because you have to ask the question again of who preserved this story and why did they want us to know it. And here is where the story of Hanukkah gets immensely complicated. Think of what happens after the temple is rededicated. After the temple is rededicated, the Maccabees enjoy the absolute rule of Jerusalem for a number of years. They had so exhausted the Greeks in the civil war that eventually they withdrew. And so for a while, they did actually have Jewish rule of the Jewish Holy Land. But here's the horrible irony of the story. The Maccabees were so devoted to tradition, once they came into power, eschewed that tradition, acted against the teachings of the rabbi and of the Torah, and became a notoriously corrupt empire. An empire so corrupt that at the time of 70, which is when the temple was destroyed by the Roman Empire and Judaism has changed forever, it's possible for the Roman Empire to do that because the empire was so rotten at the heart of it. What to make of such a terrifically confusing and complicated story? Well, perhaps we can go back to the two questions. Who preserved Judaism and why? And is assimilation dangerous, like the story seems to say? Well, let's go to the question of who preserved the tradition. After the Maccabees Empire collapses and the temple is destroyed, Judaism changes forever. it becomes what we now call rabbinical Judaism. Instead of being a religion that will gain its identity by being practiced in the public space, it becomes something different. The rabbis, the teachers, take the place of the priests and try to show the people that Judaism can be preserved in the heart, even when there is danger in public expression. The rabbis try to rearticulate and codify Judaism so it becomes something they can take with them as they spread across the world and the diaspora begins. You know what? The rabbis did not want to teach the story of the Maccabees. The rabbis were convinced that the Maccabees taught exactly the wrong lesson by implying that Judaism would survive by being an expression of power and boldness. The rabbis believed, in other words, that Judaism would only survive if people carried it within their own selves. More so, the rabbis were convinced that if there was a problem with assimilation, it was a problem that the Maccabees had, that they turned to force. The rabbis believed that because they turned to force, they in fact had taken on the lesson of their oppressors and abandoned true Judaism. So is Hanukkah a story about who preserves the tradition? It might be. But if it is a story about who preserves the tradition, the answer is not the Maccabees. Oh, it's so complicated. And what about the dangers of assimilation then? Were the Maccabees correct that assimilation was a problem for the survival of Judaism? If again we take the context of the celebration of the story itself, it seems like the answer is no, for here's the great irony. Those who maintain the pure Jewish practice also abandon the story of the Maccabees. To this day, the book of Maccabees is not included in Hebrew scripture. We have no existing copies even in Hebrew. The only way we have access to this text is in Greek through the Christian scriptures. Who kept this story alive so that we would know it? The answer is those Hellenized Greeks against whom the Maccabees acted decided that this was a sacred story that we should know to this day. Why? Why would you preserve the story of your oppressor? And here I'd like to bracket for just a minute the question of Hanukkah, and we'll come back to it, to say that I think this is the central question of any religious holiday. Who saves the tradition? Who tells the story? Who preserves the story? And why? And whether or not you come yourself from a specific religious tradition, isn't this a question we all have to ask around the holidays? What traditions are we going to preserve? What traditions are we going to abandon? And which traditions are saving traditions? Which traditions actually nourish us and help us on our spiritual path? And which might actually destroy part of our spiritual commitment? It's a complicated question, but oh, it plays out in so many ways this time of year. I mean, even on the level of the completely trivial, you know, whose family are you having holidays with this year? Do we invite Uncle X, even though Uncle X is going to start a fight with Cousin Y? Do we have the traditional Christmas open house, even though it means that Aunt J is going to have too much to drink and get in a fight with? Do we have to have the turkey? I know in my family, we have exactly three family members who feel entitled to the wing. Now, I'm committed to organic eating, but if they could genetically modify a turkey so it had three wings, I would buy it in a flash. And it seems like these questions are small, but they're not. And if you've ever tried to negotiate new traditions with your family, you know exactly what I speak. I mean, think of gift giving. It's quite easy to come to the conclusion, really, that gift-giving might be the part of the holiday that's destroying and not saving. But have you tried to have this conversation with your family? Have you tried to be the Switzerland that negotiates this? How do we save traditions? Why do we save traditions? Do they nourish us or not? And I've talked about the mundane things of everyday life and meals and family and gifts, but it is, of course, also a deeply religious and spiritual question. The holidays come around, and we want to have a deep holiday. We want the holiday to be spiritually meaningful to us, and yet we're always not always sure how to have access to which part of that tradition is saving and which is not. Perhaps we grew up in a religious tradition that's different than our religious convictions presently. What do we keep? What do we throw away? What of the past do we need to honor, and what no longer fits with who we are? Or even if you haven't changed your religious ideas from your childhood to now, just the fact that these holidays come around every year makes you answer the question all over again. That is, after all, the point of a liturgical cycle, to say that whatever question it is that the holiday asks is going to be answered differently this year because you are different this year. Whatever questions of hope or redemption have to be asked are going to be different from what you have lived over the course of a year. And so the cycle returns every year. Now, I'm just talking now about what happens in our own private homes, in our families, in our houses. But it's this question of saving traditions gets so much more complicated when you also include the public. Think of what happens in the public sphere on this question of tradition. We are insane about it. There will be, I will make a psychic prediction now, it's the only one of my whole career, there will be an argument this month about whether or not a menorah, a Kwanzaa candle, a Christmas tree, a Santa, or a Rudolph should show up on some lawn, on some courthouse, on some innocuous part of this country. You know that that argument is going to happen. And you know when that argument happens, it's going to happen with much energy and much fear. Because when you talk about preserving traditions, you don't want to underestimate the fear. W.S. Merman, the poet, said, "Show me what you are scared of, what you think is vanishing, and I will tell you who you are." Which is why people fight the holidays out in the public sphere in such aggressive and horrible ways. And again, why? What would make someone feel that Christianity, for example, as a world religion, is going to be placed in danger if we simply start saying happy holidays? What is about this, and how can we change it? What traditions save, and what traditions destroy? Of course, it gets even more complicated when you think about how most holidays bear little resemblance. Their current practice and celebration bears little resemblance to what they might have been at their origin. Jane Zepka is one of our Unitarian Universalist ministers, and I just had the privilege of reading one of her Christmas sermons, and I thought it was great. The refrain she kept using throughout the sermon was, "Because a baby was born 2,000 years ago, why am I at the mall fighting for a parking space?" So she goes through the different evolutions of how Christmas has been celebrated, always coming back to that question, "So because a baby was born 2,000 years ago, why am I at the mall fighting for a parking space?" Now, of course, the danger of asking that question is you can quickly conclude that we should throw out both the baby and the parking space, right? Since there is no obvious connection between the baby and the parking space, and there's 2,000 years of confusing and odd, you know, paths along the way, why not just get rid of them both? But that's not what Jane Zepka's point is. She offers this to us as an opportunity and a reminder to say that the holidays are waiting for us to invent them. And that this has always been the case. She specifically, in her sermon, addresses the history of Christmas, which is something I'm always delighted to talk about, because Christmas never had anything to do with Christ. We're absolutely certain about that. Christmas started out as a holiday of revelry and misbehavior and drunkenness, and it was about bands of young men going through the street, stealing things from the homes of the wealthy. Christmas was transformed in the 19th century by Unitarians and Universalists, I kid you not, simply because they wanted to get the ruffians off the street. They brought Christmas into the home and started to celebrate Christmas in the church, something that was greeted with absolute scandal by all other Christian traditions, who said very clearly that Christmas is not a biblical holiday. And so, when you hear we have to return Christ to Christmas, the idea of associating Christ and Christmas, believe me, it is absolutely brand new. And the idea that Christmas has somehow suffered for commercialization, it's never been anything other. Okay, granted, it used to be about stealing luxury goods. And now it's about purchasing luxury goods. But it's hard to say that Christmas was once an ascetic holiday where people contemplated in a spirit of purity of heart how they might deny themselves for the cause of peace and love. I don't see that in the tradition. Now, we might be wrong that. But the interesting thing about Jane's sermon and about, and we're going to return here to the history of Hanukkah, is the reminder that there is no one holiday. There is no one holiday that has always meant the same thing throughout history. These holidays are symbols that are available to us culturally that mean different things in different times and which are therefore still available to us to make meaning with. For example, let's do return to Hanukkah. When Hanukkah was first celebrated by the Maccabees, it was a patriotic holiday. It was like the 4th of July. It was to commemorate this military victory. After the rabbis got a hold about it, it meant the opposite. The rabbis made the story of Hanukkah about the miracle of the oil surviving because they very specifically wanted to make the point that the Maccabees' military victory accomplished nothing, and that military victories accomplish nothing if not accompanied